Hello and welcome to the LSEG Sustainable Growth Podcast, where we talk to leading experts about sustainability and finance and everything in between. I'm Jane Goodland, and this week we have something a little bit different for you because we're talking to Donald Bundy, who's the Professor of Epidemiology and Development at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is one of the world's leading public health universities. He's also the director of the Global Research Consortium for School Health and Nutrition. Now, cast your mind back to your childhood, and I'm sure you'll remember school dinners with varying degrees of fondness. I must say, I've never been a fan of rice pudding ever since my first encounters with it in the dinner hall in my primary school. Anyway, today's episode, we explore why we should actually rethink the humble school dinner. And Don will argue that, in fact, that they could be a fundamental and compelling driver for sustainable economic growth around the world. But before we hear from Don, a quick reminder to follow us and rate us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other platform you use. Right, enjoy the show. Let's hear from Don. Well, a very warm welcome to you, Don. Thanks so much for joining us today. It does actually feel like quite some time ago that you and I first talked about doing this episode. So I'm really looking forward to getting into the conversation eventually today. So just to be clear who you are and what you do, you're a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, but you wear a lot of other hats. I was just looking at your LinkedIn page today, and frankly, just watching it and reading it made me tired. So tell me about your career, because I believe it started actually in Jamaica at the University of the West Indies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Jane. And it's a pleasure for me to be able to talk about these issues with you. Yeah, I started a long time ago in the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica. That was my very first professional job. And it was the beginning of a 20 plus year academic career. So I spent 6 to 7 years there. And that's the time Bob Marley was still alive. It was the time of fire over Babylon, the cricket debacles and so forth. It was politically very interesting. It's actually been very powerful for me in my career since then, in creating my own character and helping me develop, because a lot of the things we talk about now around decolonizing courses and so forth as academics, well, that was the time when they were decolonizing the university. The university used to be an external college of London University. So really growing it into the great independent university that it is now is, you know, was part of that. Yeah, so I started there. And that's really what cemented my early interest in the development of children, particularly school children and adolescents. So a lot of people had worked on early child development. Still today, it's the majority focus. But I rapidly realized how important those years were for children after those vital early years, when they started to go to school and as they grew up. And the that whole, we talk about the whole 7,000 days after the first 1,000 days, when children are becoming adults, when they go through puberty and they end up as adults and they end up as educated and healthy adults if you do things right. So that became my area of interest. When I left Jamaica, it was back to the UK to Imperial College again for about 7 years. I have a rather biblical trend to my career progression, and that then focusing lots of support from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, on working with countries to create programs to support school children in terms of their health and development. And then from Imperial to Oxford University. And that kind of was the end of that phase of my academic development, because in around the 90s, the World Bank introduced the idea of human capital, the idea that they should invest in people in the same way they'd historically invested in infrastructure. And I was one of a then relatively small group that worked on the issue of, you know, what does it take to develop a person? What is it you need to invest in? And I went over for a 2-year fellowship with the World Bank, which became a 15-year stay. Again, the first 7 years were with the policy unit there on, you know, what do you do? What is it that countries might do to ensure that children grow up and become successful and prosperous adults? And then the second part was working very specifically with Africa, although I worked in other regions too, on rolling those things out. And, You know, over those 15 years, I worked with 75 governments on actual programs. So this was a sort of doing phase of my career. And then from there, I joined the Gates Foundation. I was an advisor in the global health team, senior advisor in the global health team for a few years before I came back to Britain, which is where I'm from and where I am now.
And so let's move on to what you're doing currently. So you're at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, but you're also involved with the School Meals Coalition and the Global Research Consortium. So I'm kind of interested to explore, how have you ended up doing that and what is it?
Right, good question. So a little context here. I talked about the importance of those early years, the schooling years for development of children. Back in 2008, the fuel, food and financial crisis of 2008, a terrible crisis worldwide, struck first in the low-income countries with food prices going out of control. And countries were being offered by development agencies financing, and they chose to use it to support school meals programs. They chose to use the money to invest in their school children. This was actually quite a surprise for most development people in those days. But we began to realize why that was, that this wasn't just about making sure children aren't hungry at school. This was about actually supporting this development of human capital. It was guaranteeing the country's future. This was investing in their next generation. And it became clear as that crisis turned into a worldwide recession that this wasn't just a problem for low-income countries. This was a problem too. Well, we saw that the school meals programs became something that from Scotland to Spain were being used by what I would describe as the rich countries, the high-income countries, to support their children in the same way. I'm going to come back to talking about COVID a bit later, but you know what we saw with Marcus Rashford coming forward and talking about schools being open during the summer vacation and so forth, and supporting all the children who were in school. That sort of thinking actually started back then in 2010 as a way of responding to the recession. So what we saw after that, so we saw the two examples that I was most closely associated with at that time was Russia and China. Both launched major school meals programs, and following this idea that you were investing in children, the idea that this was a program that was a social protection program as much as it was a nutrition program. And over the next decade up till 2020, we saw this huge growth worldwide, and school meals became the world's most extensive social safety net. It became the case that most countries had a school meals program, something like 50%, approaching 50% of primary school children worldwide were receiving free school meals paid for by the countries themselves. It was a huge change. And then I'm saying 2020 because you'll realize that's when COVID arrived, right? So 2020, 420 million children being fed every day in school. What do we decide to do? We decide to close all the schools worldwide. The first time that had ever been attempted, and it was miserably successful. Very few countries didn't close their schools. Most countries did, and that had terrible consequences. So this was taking away the safety net that had been carefully built over the last 10 years. And what did we see happening? Well, first, of course, education stopped. But then we discovered that schools were also the way that most systems chose to reach school-aged children and adolescents. And all of those support structures were just taken away. And children no longer had the security of schools. So we saw a rise in child marriages. We saw girls getting married much earlier. They were no longer schoolgirls. They were now out in the community. We saw a rise in young pregnancy, in too early pregnancy. We saw, with boys in particular, inappropriate labor becoming a big factor. There were really poor consequences for this socially. And some of the schools didn't open for years. Some countries closed their schools for 2 or in some cases 3 years during the COVID pandemic, with terrible consequences for their children. And what happened then is very important, that the parents of these children said, what's going on here? We need to fix this. the governments, listening to their voters, said, yeah, we need to do that. And the governments got together. They created a coalition. They called it the School Meals Coalition, but they actually meant Supporting Children of School Age Coalition. That's really what it was about. And so they created this group back in October 21 was when it was set up. I think there were 40 countries that were part of it at that stage. Today, there's 108 countries that are part of it. This has become one of the most institutionalized groups that grew out of the COVID crisis.
And what does the coalition do then? What's the main kind of mission that it has?
Sure. So the purpose of the coalition was then to reopen and rebuild the programs that they'd had before, to get back to 2020, if you like, because everything had shut. Amazingly, they've already done that. The coalition's already achieved that, and they brought in fact, post-COVID, there have been 30 million more children part of the school meals activity. But in order to make this coalition effective, they decided to have an initiative, which they called the Research Consortium, to provide the evidence, the guidance for what countries should do to build back these programs, but to build back more efficient programs. You know, the overall goal is that every child should get a meal in school and also be supported in other health and sociological ways in school by 2030. That's the overall goal. But the reality is that countries are doing it a country at a time, and they're driving it themselves.
And the consortium is an international, like you said, there's 108 countries now involved. And I know that you like to get out and about and go and see things for yourself. And I believe you were recently in Ukraine and maybe Africa as well. Can you help us understand, just sort of bring this to life a little bit in terms of what's happening in these countries and I guess what's different from before, really?
Sure. And I want to emphasize that this is about countries doing this, right? You know, so often we talk about these kinds of programs and we're talking about NGOs and charities and things like this. This is country-led stuff. So it's a $48 billion industry, if you like, 98% supported by domestic funds. So Ukraine, you know, this is an extraordinary one, isn't it? So 18 months ago, Ukraine got in touch with us and with some other agency, but particularly they asked us to help them design a program to address the issue of the school children who were in a time of war. That was what they called it. So a couple of months ago, I had the privilege of going to Kyiv to actually launch that program with the First Lady of Ukraine, Alina Zelenska. And that's a program that's specifically about supporting those children who manage to get to school. So one of the big problems in Ukraine, as you might imagine, is there's a lot of children are learning off just online because they actually can't go to schools. All their schools have been destroyed. So they've been reopening schools, but providing food in those schools as an incentive for children to go to those schools. But also because, and this is the key point, they recognize that the future of Ukraine is these children, and that if they don't invest in these children now, they won't have a future irrespective of the outcome of the war. So they're currently feeding about 1.2 million children a day in Ukraine, with a particular focus on those kids who are in the frontline territories, children who, you know, sadly spend their entire day, their school is actually inside a bomb shelter. Those children particularly are getting support. So that's there's a country in actually a very productive country with no food security problems and so forth. But of course, we work internationally on this, and we work with many of the countries you're more used to hearing us working with worldwide. And we have a group of communities of practice. And I think this is a key point, that what we do is we work with the governments in these countries and with the experts in these countries to help accelerate the programs that are in place and to develop programs when they aren't in place. So that's the particular work of the research consortium.
It's fascinating. And I think that, you know, there's so much scope for different countries to learn from one another and actually just starting to think through, you know, this is not just, you know, having kids getting access to healthy, nutritious meals in schools. But like you say, there's so much complexity now in terms of schools may not be operating as they were because of pandemics, but also wars and conflicts and other economic situations as well. So there's a lot to kind of work through to be able to make that happen. So I can understand why actually countries need to learn from each other and work out what works. Let's think through the why a bit more, because I think we're clear on what the direct benefits to children's health is in terms of them getting a consistent source of healthy, nutritious meals in schools. But I know that there are other benefits too. And I wonder, to having kind of a really good school meals program, what are those benefits and what would incentivize countries to make that investment? Like you said, you know, the vast majority of this is from the domestic purse. So help me understand the economics and the stacking up.
And you're right. So countries are paying for this because they think it's a good investment. And our calculations are that for every dollar invested in these programs, you get a return of something between $7 and $30 back. And those are actual estimates from a range of countries. And so those are substantial returns. And they don't come from just one sector. That's really the important point. It takes a sort of Ministry of Finance view to recognize the value of this. Because let's start with health. We've talked about health, but we've talked about it almost as though it's about hunger and things. But if you set a child on the right trajectory in terms of their diet at an early stage in life, you can also address a whole range of other issues like obesity, like diabetes, and like the non-communicable diseases of middle age, which are 80% of what we spend our NHS money on. These are things you can tackle. You can save money in the long term by investing in health early.
So really that's about, I guess, you know, those formative years, making sure that children have access to good food, nutritious food, so they make better choices later on, so that they don't then have these, what people call lifestyle related diseases later in life, which of course costs countries a lot. What other benefits are there?
So those health benefits spill over to affect education. So, you know, the one thing in this world that most governments seem to agree on is that compulsory free universal education is a good investment in their nation. But what's become increasingly clear is you can't really get a good education if you don't have the well-being to learn. This is something we talk about now more in the UK than we ever did. And achieving that well-being is about school health and about school nutrition. So, you know, one way of looking at this from an economics point of view is that the world invests about $2.8 trillion in education, primary and secondary education, and that needs to be leveraged by the well-being of those children. So every dollar that goes into their well-being leverages an enormous investment that's already there for their education. But that's not all. The other key issue, and I mentioned this before, that the realization this is a social safety net for kids. This is protection for kids. More than 420 million children are being fed every day. It's not a trivial support. And each of those children, the value of those meals is about 10% of parental income, every child that goes to school. That means that there's this big return to parents if they send their children to school, and it's per child. So if you send three children, it's 30%, you know? So it's very substantial as safety nets go. But that's, again, not all, because then there's this big agricultural return. So, you know, one interesting world fact is that the USA, created its school meals program during the Depression as a way of creating a stable market for its Midwestern farmers. And it's the U.S. Department of Agriculture that still runs the school meals program in the U.S.
That's interesting, isn't it? I would never imagine that would be the genesis of school meals in the U.S. So that is fascinating. And is that the same for most countries in terms of the connection between their agricultural sector and school meals, for example?
So it's increasingly the case. And I'm going to just mention Nigeria in this context. Nigeria has gone from feeding 1 million children to 10 million children. And it's used it as a, yeah. And I'm talking now about a sustainable program that's been well monitored and well evaluated, that's actually a good return on investment. It's one of the ones that we've looked at closely. So the Nigerian government too sees this. That's not the only reason they're doing it, but that's one good part of why there's a big return overall. All of those sectoral returns add up to a significant benefit for every dollar invested in the program.
And when you look at it like that, then it really underscores why it's so important for governments to really think about this holistically. Because I suppose if you looked at the return on investment, if you were only sort of thinking about it in the context of, say, your education budget, for example, you probably wouldn't see those wider benefits. So a whole of government approach is needed, which actually brings me on quite nicely to topics that we often talk about on this podcast, which is around things like climate, et cetera, which, again, probably need a whole of government approach. And we know that sustainability is, in fact, like a web of interconnected issues. You know, none of these issues are kind of isolated in real terms. So we've talked through kind of the link between school meals and the benefits associated with children's health and long-term population health, as well as the links to the domestic economy, for example, from agriculture. But are there broader links to big global issues like climate change? How do these things connect together?
So the climate change issue is actually huge. You know, if we think about climate change, most of the COPs, most of the language we hear about is fossil fuel related languages. And that's, you know, getting on for two-thirds of the problem. But, you know, one-third of the problem is food. Food creates a third of the world's greenhouse gases. That's, you know, that's something that clearly we've not paid enough attention to. In fact, the COPs, it was COP 28 before food was on the agenda. And I can tell you, we were there at COP 28, and we were on the main stage at COP 28 with a particular storyline, which was to say that we need to do something about food. As I say, a third of greenhouse gas is due to food. A third of those losses are due to food waste. What can we do about that? The other two-thirds are about eating the wrong foods, not eating sustainable food sources. And, you know, that's, you know, looks all very self-evident. But the big story, of course, and you know, if you've read Eat Lancet and those great analyses on this, they'll, you know, we talk about a flexitarian diet or a vegan diet or a less meat diet. But how do you get to those diets? You know, we have trouble keeping going if we want to lose a few pounds, right? We, as adults, it's a very tough thing to do. But if you want to actually establish a, you know, a global change in eating habits, well, where do you start? Well, you start with the kids. And providing the right foods in schools, providing resilient foods produced in the right way in schools, making that the standard that children grow up with, is a key way to change global eating habits. And that's a big part now of the messaging. Governments are very interested in this as a key part of the messaging, not least because if of all the food that children eat, it's school meals where governments have their most of the policy levers actually already in their hands. They control these programs. So they can actually require that the schools provide food that's produced by regenerative agriculture, for example, that the power of procurement also is brought into play. And if I can just, Jane, just tell you that, so in East Africa, something rather unattractively called the orange fleshed sweet potato, which nutritionists have been promoting for a long time because it's actually a micronutrient-rich staple, has become extremely popular because it was introduced into schools. So that the children go home, they say, well, I want these orange sweet potatoes, not those white ones that I'm getting at home, you know, because they're much better for me. And then you see much more development of those kinds of products by the farmers themselves. They respond to that. And interestingly, mainly by women farmers, but sweet potatoes, legumes and such like are mainly produced by female smallholder farmers. And we see a particularly big impact in that area. So, you know, a time for change, a whole new area of school meals thinking around how can we be sustainable? How can we respect the sovereignty of food in the countries we're working with?
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. It's not just about this, like the nutrition level of the meal that the children are getting, but it's also that wider sourcing impact and kind of where the food comes from, how it's produced, etc. Do you know off the top of your head, like how much money, say, a country like the UK would spend every year on its kind of school meals?
I don't precisely know that figure because the UK is very complicated in the way in which, because the UK, we have a devolved nation system. Every one of them has a different school meals program, a different price, a different value of meals provided, different providers. It's an area of great discussion, actually, of great interest. But what I can say is that the world spends $48 billion on school meals overall. And I can tell you that the UK says that the right amount to spend on a school meal is £3.16. And I could explain to you why it's so precise and not sure I agree with it.
I think, I mean, globally, that number's like staggering, right? And I should imagine that there's always a drive to be able to understand how you drive value for money in terms of what that return on that investment is. So thinking kind of holistically about wider issues associated with climate and the impact on our agricultural processes is presumably quite helpful in terms of thinking about that wider picture. So thinking a bit more about policy levers and how governments could use that kind of drive around kind of long-term systemic change, presumably there has to be a certain mindset or a certain beliefs in place to make a government do that. And certainly very, very long-term multi-generational thinking. Are countries good at that? How are we doing on that? And what are there actually any good examples where you say that's a country who seems to be getting it right?
So it's a wonderful question. But of course, let's just look at the evidence. I mean, I think that's the right way. So there are countries are spending $48 billion. 98% of that is domestic funds. Let's be very clear, there's very little international support for these programs. They're supported by the nations themselves. We're seeing an increasing number of countries signing up. There's a real movement now towards these universal school meals. So we're seeing a real change. I can tell you in the European Union countries, for example, 26 of the 27 have school meals programs, and nearly 50% of those are universal school meals programs. In the US, states which run their school meals programs are moving towards universal school meals programs. So California, one of the largest states, has a universal program. But we're also seeing countries like, we're seeing Canada step up and say, we want to have a national program. Previously, they've had programs for some specific groups, but now they want to have, a universal approach. And then Denmark and Norway are also moving into this. Meanwhile, there are other countries that have been doing universal programs for 80 years. Sweden, Finland, Japan, and new countries doing exactly the same, South Korea joining that list. So we're seeing that, but I'd like to point out that the biggest programs in the world are not the programs in the rich countries. The biggest programs are in the world. The biggest of all is in India, where they feed 90 million children every day, universal free program in all public schools. And Brazil, 40 million every day, universal free program in all public schools. And in the case of Brazil, 30% of that money coming from family farms, to get back to the point I was making earlier. So we're not seeing a discouraging picture at all globally. This is, in fact, a very, very positive figure. I mean, I think the UK, it's extraordinary that the UK isn't doing more in this area, frankly. They're not part of the school meals coalition, despite having themselves a school meals program for 130 years that survived 30 changes of government. They've got a lot to share with the rest of the world, but they've, for whatever reason, decided not to step up on that. Maybe I could make a final point, which is that the big movement that's happening now globally is the creation of a school meals impact accelerator. Countries aren't asking for money to maintain their programs. They're finding that those resources. But some countries want some help to actually scale up what they're doing. And that's why it's called an impact accelerator. So I'd mentioned Nigeria. Nigeria's gone from 1 to 10 million children. Now it wants to go from 10 million to 20 million. That's a step up. It needs some help to step up, even though it will pay for the food and all of the programs. Indonesia has decided to launch its national program. 30 million children are being targeted. Again, it would be very helpful if there was a fund that could help with that. And so much of our occupation around how do we support and invest globally in this is to create a school meals impact accelerator fund. And already some of the big foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, have already made commitments to take that forward. That's the frontier at the moment.
That's so fascinating, Don. And I think that it's really shown that we really should rethink the school meal, because it's more than simply filling some child's tummy in the middle of the day. It's about so much more than that. It's about kind of the health of our nation and the future prosperity of the world. So yes, a lot to think about. Thank you so much for all the work you do and also sharing that with us today and the listeners. So thank you once again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Jane, for listening, giving us this opportunity.
So that's it for this episode, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Don Bundy from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Incredible to think how school dinners could in fact change the world. If you've got questions, comments, or someone you'd like us to talk to, then do get in touch by email at fmt@lseg.com. That's all from me, but watch out for the next episode very soon.